our overall critique of the continental rationalist, this is the bottom line, if you will, overall, most general critique, is that if what they are saying is based on self-evident truths, why then do the rationalists disagree so radically with each other? Their metaphysical views tend to go all different directions: dualism, monism, atomism, and this doesn't give us a lot of confidence that they really were basing their thinking on self-evident truths and clearly and certainly in mathematical form deducing their conclusions. So we can understand why the British empiricists were rather frustrated with the metaphysical speculations of the continental philosophers, and the general trend in British philosophy then is to try to become more commonsensical, more concrete, more in touch with our empirical experience, and trying to figure out what the world is like based on experience rather than rational speculation. So we're moving now in our outline to Roman numeral 22, British empiricism, and again we have three major philosophers that we'll look at: John Locke, George Berkeley, and David Hume. But I put up on the board here a list of the philosophers, the major philosophers that we have studied or are about to study. In their, what's in the column here with the names is, if you will, their birth order, not their death order. Some have shorter and longer lives and so forth, but in terms of order of birth. And then what I've also done is I've put down the dates for flourishing as I have chosen those dates. You don't have to do it this way necessarily, but I've taken their major publication or publications and use that as a date of flourishing. And where you see a crossing, you know, here on the board, that's because I want these dates to be in chronological order. But the date of flourishing is not necessarily in order with the date of birth for these people. And so in the case of Hobbes, though he was born before Descartes, Descartes published before Hobbes. Okay? So Hobbes published after his younger contemporary, Descartes. So that's why you see a crossing. The same thing happens with Leibniz and Berkeley here. Leibniz was born before Berkeley, but Berkeley published 4 years before him. So that's why you see the crossing of the dates of flourishing. And I just hope by looking at this, you'll see not only these crossings, but also you notice that continental rationalism is not a distinct, separate period of time from British empiricism. Because the rationalists are who? Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz. Notice this. Locke was born the same year as Spinoza. He lived much longer than Spinoza, but he was born the same year as Spinoza. Locke was born before Leibniz. Okay? And so Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz, if you looked at their careers, it is, as it were, looking back now artificially, their career as continental rationalists was interrupted by the birth and the career of Locke. Okay? And that even though Berkeley follows Leibniz in the order of birth, Berkeley nevertheless published before Leibniz. So the chart hopefully will point out to you that, again, we have not a merging, it's not a bringing it together, but the age of continental rationalism is not watertight from the age of British empiricism. These overlap each other. There's an intertwining. So that Leibniz will actually be able to answer some of the criticisms of Locke directed at rationalism. And I'll note that when we get further into Locke. Okay, the three major British empiricists, to remind you again, Locke, 1700 1632 to 1704, Barclay, 1685 to 1753, and Hume, 1711 to 1776. Now that's convenient, isn't it? Because at least you can remember that. Most American students will be able to remember that Hume died the year that the Declaration of Independence was issued. Okay, so that's bringing us pretty close to our own history. We're now coming up to time that's easier for us to understand in terms of the period in which we live. Kant, 1724 to 1804, is a crucial thinker for the history of Western thought, publishes in 1781 his major critique of pure reason. In 1804, he dies. So essentially, we can say that when Kant dies, we now have the 19th century, which is the century right before our own. So when we finish the names on the board, we will be getting awfully close to the day in which we live. Hume dies in the year of our Declaration of Independence. Kant dies at the very opening of the 19th century. Okay, I just want to make sure you keep track of that. Let me give you what these dates are for. 1637 is Descartes' Discourse on Method. 1651 will be Hobbes' Leviathan. 1670 will be Spinoza's Treatise on Theology and Politics. 1690, 20 years later, you have Locke's Essay on Human Understanding, and in the same year, his two treatises on government. That was a big year for Locke, obviously. Okay, then 1710, we have the younger contemporary of Leibniz writing Principles of Human Understanding. Berkeley wrote Principles of Human Understanding. 4 years later, the continental rationalist Leibniz comes out with his Monadology. 1748, I've chosen as the flourishing date for Hume, an inquiry concerning human understanding. Remember, that is inquiry, to be distinguished from the earlier work called the Treatise. And then 1781, the date for Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. Before we look at the details of Locke's life and philosophy, let me just say a word about the school of thought, British empiricism. Remember, we're on Roman numeral 22 in your outline. The British empiricist, I think, can be distinguished by three things. First of all, a seeking of common sense, practicality, and observation, a putting of an emphasis on, seeking after, being interested in, focusing on common sense, practicality, and observation over against the speculative mathematical certainty as the ideal of knowledge in continental rationalism. I've said this over and over again, so I hope it's sinking in. The continental rationalists make their ideal for knowledge the speculative mathematical ideal. They seek certainty, as you get in mathematics. The British empiricists have a different ideal and focus, if you will. They're looking for common sense, practicality, and an observational approach to knowledge. Secondly, British empiricism is characterized by a denial of innate ideas. Whatever we know by observation. And I'm not going to hesitate to jump in right now and offer a critique of this. I hope for all, I know we have to go quickly through this material and you may feel blitzed, but either in class or afterwards, stop and reflect on these things. What does this mean? What would you say to somebody who says, everything we know by observation? You might want to say, well, do we know that by observation? Do we know that everything we know is based on observation? Is that an observational truth? And so one of the things you want to get down, remember this as you'll probably be asked on the final, if nothing else, but for life, remember this too, empiricism contradicts itself. There's an inherent contradiction in this denial of innate ideas that says we only know things by observation. Well, if we only know things by observation, then we should be able to observe somehow that we only know things by observation. But of course, that is not something that's available as an observational truth. And why is that? Because of the third distinctive of British empiricism, only particulars exist. If only particulars exist, then I can't know any universal statement by observation, can I? Well, unless I have universal experience. If I've observed every possible thing, then I might say we only know things by observation. I could build it up, you know, increment by increment by increment until it finally fills everything, but no one has that ability. Since you can't build it up incrementally and no one has an experience of a universal, here's a universal, you only know things by observation. See, that's a universal truth. But you don't observe any universal truths, so it turns out that empiricism is self-contradictory. But that third distinctive is only particulars exist. See the emphasis on concrete factuality? You see, rather than rational certainty. Only particulars exist. In parentheses, you may want to note, this is in the Middle Ages way of putting things known as nominalism. Only particulars exist. And now I'd like to do just a brief critique of that view that only particulars exist. We've already critiqued the notion that you can only know things by observation. There are no innate ideas. Well, if only particulars exist, then are there kinds of things at all? I know this is not the way you usually speak, so I'm going to say it over again, write it in your notes. Do kinds of things exist? This is easy. You go to different kinds of stores, don't you? You go to the hardware store, you can go to the grocery store. Now, I realize that the larger grocery stores are trying to encroach upon and will sell some items of hardware. And I've even seen some hardware stores that will have cases of Coke or something, which is more properly a grocery item. But forgetting that overlap, we all know the difference between a grocery store and a hardware store because of the kinds of things that are in them, right? Well, do kinds of things exist? Are similarities between things or classes of things real? Do barns exist? Now that is purposely ambiguous. Do barns exist? From an empirical standpoint, you could say barn 1, barn 2, barn 3 exist. Yeah, barns plural, meaning 1, 2, and 3 brought together. Yeah, they exist. Yeah, but is the very thing you're calling them, barn, does that exist? Is there such a thing as a similarity? Okay. You would be inclined to think, because we generally are very naive philosophically about these abstract questions, you'd say, well, yeah, I look at barn 1, I look at barn 2, I look at barn 3, and now I have an idea of barn, what is common to things that we call barns. But you see, if you're a nominalist, if you're a British empiricist who says only particulars exist, then you don't really have an idea of barn, do you? The idea of barn is not something that you experience. By idea here, I mean the general idea of barnness. When we get to Berkeley, we'll see this, and then Hume will drive it home with a vengeance. We don't experience anything general. You know? You may go to a hardware store, but no one's ever experienced hardware. Right? You've experienced hammers and nails and saws and, you know, polishing wax for your car and so forth, but you've never experienced hardware. By the way, no one has ever purchased groceries. I know there's an ambiguity in our language to say, well, where were you? Well, I was out buying groceries. Oh, would you please bring me? Don't bring me any particular grocery now. I don't want an apple or a box of cake mix. Bring me groceries. Well, the empiricist would point out, we don't have any general ideas. We don't experience groceriness or hardwareness and so forth. Okay? And I take this as a critique of British empiricism, because if there is no reality to kinds of things, then what are we talking about? We're talking about something that's not real. I'm going to the grocery store. You liar, there is no such thing as grocery. Oh, by the way, there's also no such thing as store. All right? Store is a general kind of thing. So, you're not going to the grocery and you're not going to the store. And by the way, going is a general kind of thing. So you're not going either, because going is unreal. That's just a term. Oh, and guess what? I don't exist either. Because no one experiences identity over time. They only experience momentary sensations. There's no I-ness about it. And so this started out as a polite critique, but you can see the empiricist is getting pretty bruised and bloodied by this now. Because if empiricism is correct, then I can't even speak of anything. I am going to the grocery store every single, well, am may not be, I don't know. But apart from the grammatical helps there, every significant word in that sentence is a kind. I am a kind of individual experiences over time. Going is a kind, it's not a particular. Grocery is not a particular. Store is not a particular. And so when you say only particulars exist, what happens? You make knowledge impossible. If you take that seriously, that only particulars exist, then you can never talk about general things. You can never talk about goings, personal identities. You cannot talk about types of things, grocery versus hardware, or stores, or what have you. If everything is different, if everything is particular and doesn't fit into a kind, into a class, or to use the ancient language, is not part of a universal, if the only thing that's real are the particulars, then you can't know particulars either. And this is going to be the history of British empiricism. Locke will start out trying to be, although I don't agree with his theology altogether, trying to be a good Christian, but trying to be very scientific and get away from the vain speculation of the rationalists and so forth. He's going to set up an epistemology that has its internal problems he doesn't realize. Barclay will take it another step further. He says, well, if I follow Locke, there's no material substance. The world's made up of experiences, not of an underlying matter behind the experiences. Hume will say, well, but Barclay, the only thing that kept you from going all the way is that you're trying to be a good Christian. Barclay, too, is trying to do apologetics. He's trying to show that God exists and the atheists are wrong and so forth. But you see, once you, these guys, Locke and Barclay, they've got a theory of knowledge that doesn't accord with Christianity. But they, in their heart of hearts, wish to be Christians. They really did. I mean, again, I don't approve of their theology altogether, but Locke wrote apologetical treatises, evidences for Christianity. Barclay argued for the existence of God against atheism and so forth. He was a bishop in the church and so forth. The only thing that kept them from taking their epistemology to its logical conclusions, that you couldn't know anything, was that they were holding on religiously to a certain view of life that really didn't mix in with their theory of knowledge. So what happens when you get a Scottish skeptic like Hume, who despises religion? He finally takes Locke's epistemology and he goes right to the wall with it, and he concludes you can't know anything. You can't know about God, you can't know about science either. As a matter of fact, we can't know anything. Can't even know that there's a self. can't know that there's an enduring external world, can't know any causal relationships in this world. And then Hume has all these headaches, and oh man, what do I do? All these philosophical problems. He can't answer the philosophical problems, and so he says, I go play backgammon with my friends. Yeah, I don't mind you laughing, it is laughable, but it's also deplorable. Here's a man who his philosophy leads him one way, but he says, I can't live with that, so I'll just stop thinking about it and go out and play a game of checkers or something, you know? So that's my overall view of British empiricism. We have to get down into the forest now and eat a little bark here, get particular about the trees. But I want you to know the three distinctives. Make sure they're in your notes. I want you to be able to critique British empiricism on those two points especially. No innate ideas and only particulars exist. And then I want you to be able to explain to me the evolution, if you will, from Locke through Berkeley to the skepticism of Hume. Remember, the only thing that kept Locke and Berkeley from running up against the wall of skepticism that Hume did is that they had a Christian anchor. They were not being good Christian philosophers. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that they personally were not willing to go where their logic would have taken them. Okay, John Locke. 1632 to 1704, Locke was educated at Oxford. And he said he was there perplexed with obscure terms and useless questions because of the instruction there being of the more scholastic type. Now, you've got to like Locke, because my guess is I have probably in this class, you've been too polite to tell me this, but I've in this class, I've brought you to the same frustration, haven't I? If you've been paying attention to all this, you look at this series of thoughts and you say, it is just so. This has nothing to do with common sense. You know? No one knows what they're talking about. It's a bunch of pompous language and it's not getting anywhere. Now, if I haven't frustrated you that way, I probably haven't done as good a job as I should, but you should feel that. After you've studied the continental rationalist, you say, what is this all about? Who cares, finally? You know, is the world one big monad or a bunch of monads or a substance or, you know, who? Interaction, I know interaction takes place, but I can't figure it out philosophically. So what we tend to do is we just want to say, don't study philosophy. And there's a little aside here. In all honesty, I think that's one of the major reasons why in the late 20th century it's very hard to get people to study philosophy. Universities will have a requirement. You've got to take an intro to philosophy course or a logic course and so forth. And that's about the only way you can force people to get in there. And then you get a few weird people like Dr. Bonson who say, hey, I'm interested in this. I like this abstract thinking and so forth. And you'll get a few philosophy majors. But most people, so I mean, feel good about yourself. You're not out of step. Most people, by the time they get here in the history of philosophy, are ready to say, forget it. You know, I've got to mow the lawn, do something practical with my life. Who wants to study philosophy? Well, so Locke said he went to Oxford and he was, and I'm quoting, perplexed with obscure terms and useless questions. He took up medicine for a career. In 1667, he became the personal physician and confidant of the Earl of Shaftesbury. And so this, because of the Earl's political connections and activity, led Locke to be an advisor to someone who was a minister of state. And just, it's a piece of historical curiosity, but I thought you'd enjoy this. Locke was one of the people who helped to draft in the year 1669 the Constitution for the colony of Carolina. Where are we right now? So the history of this area has something to do with Locke. Shaftesbury was a politician, very active. I can't get into his career, but he got himself into trouble. Eventually he was dismissed from office and had to flee to Holland. Locke agreed with Shaftesbury, at least to this degree. He may not have liked his what got him into trouble. But Locke agreed with him that parliamentary rights need to be preserved over against royal prerogative. The rights of the parliament need to be defended against the king's encroachments. Okay, my friends, look at the dates of Locke again, just so you know how important this is. 1632 to 1704. What period of time is this known as? The Puritan Revolution in England, okay? So Locke is on the parliamentary side. Locke is a Protestant. And again, we have our theological differences, but Locke, you see, is close to our Puritan forefathers and some of their sympathies. In 1683, after the monarchy has been restored, Locke had to flee to Holland himself because of his parliamentary sympathies. But who does he meet in Holland? That's right, William of Orange. This is an amazing period of time. I love the study of it, I guess because I love the Westminster Assembly and its context. But anyway, Locke goes to Holland. He meets their Prince William and Princess Mary of Orange. And as you know, eventually the Stuart monarchy is thrown out in England, and William and Mary come to power in 1688 after the Bloodless Revolution. Well, as William and Mary come back from Holland to take their position, Locke returns in the entourage of the Queen. And now Locke is in a very favorable position to publish his views. Notice in 1690, 2 years after the William and Mary ascension to power, in 1690, Locke publishes his two most famous writings, two treatises on government and an essay concerning human understanding. Many theologians bitterly attacked Locke's views, and he engaged in a long exchange of replies and counter-replies and so forth. And I have trouble with Locke's theology, too. I've said that a number of times already. I won't repeat it again. But the fact of the matter is, Locke was, and he attempted to be, a godly man. He did study the Bible. He was very interested in the epistles of Paul, made an extensive study of them, wrote books on evidences and so forth. He died in the year 1704. Okay, enough of biography on Locke. We're going to try to cover very quickly here six things about Locke. First of all, his new paradigm of philosophy, his new paradigm of reasoning. Secondly, his rejection of innate ideas. Thirdly, his psychology of knowing, his psychology of knowing. Fourthly, his theory of knowledge, his epistemology. Fifthly, his ethics. And then sixth, his politics. And we'll spend more time on Locke than we do on Berkeley. And by the time we get to Hume, we really can accelerate things, because it won't be hard to see what Hume is doing. He's just taking what Locke planted and helping it to grow. Okay, first of all, Locke and the new paradigm of philosophy, the new paradigm of reasoning. Where Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz took the mathematical element of knowledge as the ideal of certainty and formulated their criterion of truth and also their criterion of reality in terms of logic, if you will, Locke and his followers wanted to rely not on logic, not on reasoning, but on sense perception for obtaining knowledge about the world. Their aim was experimental verification rather than rational deduction. And they didn't find it a bad thing that you can't have certainty in most fields of inquiry. The most you can have is a very high likelihood or probability of things. This is just to say that their empirical emphasis wanted to be commonsensical. They were frustrated with the speculative theories of the continental rationalists. So the rationalists wanted what was indubitable, the rational ideal of math, but Locke said concrete, practical experience may not be very tidy, but it's more helpful. And so, how did Locke begin to do his philosophy? Well, with this empirical tendency that I've already pointed to, Locke said we shouldn't begin to philosophize. So the empirical approach to philosophy doesn't want to begin with speculations about ultimate truth and reality. It says, how will we know about ultimate truth or any truth that we can find? Well, we'll know it with the use of our mind. So what is the mind like? In a few moments, we're going to get to what I called his psychology of knowing. But this is crucial. Epistemology is something of a psychological study when you get to the British empiricist, because you can't know what the world is like until you first of all know what the mind is like that knows that world out there. So Locke wanted to make a fresh start. Well, boy, this isn't new, is it? This idea of a fresh start isn't very fresh, that's for sure. Every one of these philosophers says, everybody in the past was confused. What we need to do is start with a good instrument of knowing. You know what Descartes did? Descartes said, everybody's got all these weird ideas and so forth. I'm going to figure out that method where you can begin with something very basic and primal and by certain steps work out what your philosophy is. It's almost like if people would just begin again with my approach to doing things, then we could finally learn. Now, I'm not trying to make fun of Locke or Descartes, because this is not always self-conscious pride, but it is nevertheless pride, isn't it? It may not be malicious, it may not be, you know, like, oh, I'm so smart and everybody else is so dumb, but there's a great pride involved in saying everybody before got messed up because they didn't use the method that I've come up with. Well, Locke was in, you know, that train of thought. He wants to make a fresh start. He believed that man is competent to cure all his ills, cognitive and moral, if he would just use his natural powers properly. Descartes thought we used our natural thinking powers, our reason, properly if we follow mathematical patterns. But what did I say Locke was what was his profession? He was a physician. And so what Locke took to be reason was more in line with the kind of thing doctors do than with the kind of thing that mathematicians like Descartes do. Now, I had told you in a previous lecture, this word reason is the real bugaboo in the history of philosophy. Reason means a zillion different, I mean, I don't know if it's a zillion, but you get my point, a whole bunch of different and conflicting things. Descartes would say he was committed to reason as his final authority. Locke would say he was committed to reason as his final authority, but they didn't mean the same thing by reason, did they? Locke realized that the kind of reasoning he wanted to do about the world, which means getting in touch with concrete events, would not give us absolute certainty. But on the other hand, he said, it's unrealistic to look for absolute certainty, and all we need to expect in this life is what we can get through our experience. So not only do the rationalist and the empiricist have a different view of reason, they have a different view of what philosophy is all about, too. And I'm pointing this out because I want you to know that ultimately the disagreements between philosophers are presuppositional in character. It's not that Descartes went to do his philosophy and Locke went to do his philosophy and they came up with different answers and we just need to check their homework to see who did it right. That is a naive view of the history of philosophy. The problem is that Descartes had a different view of what it was to do your homework than Locke did. It isn't just that they're trying to play the same game and they come up with different conclusions. They had a different idea of what the game of philosophy is all about, if I can put it that way. They differed as to their view of reason. They also, you see, to do philosophy is to seek mathematical certainty if you're a rationalist. Whereas the British empiricist says, don't. You know, what a waste of time. That's not available. Who cares about that? To do philosophy is to gain the practical control over the world that observation and experience can give you. Where the continental rationalists thought that their a priori methods, is this term a priori new to you? A priori comes from the Latin meaning ahead of time, if I can put it that way, prior to. We know things prior to observation, if you hold to an a priori approach. Now, prior to observation doesn't have to mean temporally prior to. What it means is we know things that are not dependent upon observation. So we know them a priori. The opposite point of view is known as an a posteriori. A posteriori means, well, you know what your posterior is. Where is your posterior? It's behind you. And so you know things in a posterior way after the fact, if you will, after observation and experience. The continental rationalists thought that their a priori methods could be satisfactorily applied to other fields of thought, physics, psychology, what have you. And what that led them into, I think we would all say, are speculative flights, you know. We have these dream philosophies that don't have a whole lot to do with the world in which we live. Moreover, there are contradictions that they are led into. Descartes' interaction. How can there be interaction? Contradictions between Descartes and Spinoza, Spinoza and Leibniz, and so forth. But Locke didn't think there was something wrong with reason. The problem with the continental rationalists is not that they were following reason, it's that they had the wrong idea of what reason is and what you should expect from it. Providing we know how to employ the instrument of reason and don't ask too much from it, Locke said, reason is a perfectly adequate tool. And you'll be interested from a Christian perspective to know that he called reason, quote, the candle of the Lord set up by himself in men's minds. The candle of the Lord. Well, I realize that's flowery language, but I like that sentiment. But then he went on to say, it must be our last judge and guide in everything. Anybody see the internal tension in that? If reason is the candle of the Lord, one might think that the Lord expects his candle to be used the way he wants it to be used. That is, the final authority would be the Lord who provides the candle. But Locke, you see, I told you about this before. I hope you can draw this conclusion yourself. Locke looked at reason as an instrument. That's fine. But then he turned it into an authority, and that's not so fine. The candle of the Lord can't be the final authority, can it? But that's the way he tried to treat it. Locke maintained that he was trying to be neutral on all metaphysical issues as he began his philosophy. Metaphysics is the study of the nature, origin, structure of reality. So Locke said, I'm not going to begin with any major metaphysical conclusions here about what reality must be like. I'm going to be neutral on this. But despite his stated intention to not begin with metaphysics, he nevertheless, without realizing it, assumed many metaphysical positions as he went about his development of epistemology. Hear what I'm saying. Locke said, I'm going to be neutral as to metaphysics and develop my epistemology. Dr. Bonson says, and by the way, I'm not alone in this, believers and unbelievers both have observed this about Locke, although he intended to be neutral, the very way he pursued his epistemology already committed him to certain metaphysical positions. So he may not have recognized it or been self-conscious about it, but he had a metaphysic when he was pursuing his epistemology. And I'm going to stop now and generalize because I want you to learn, you know, wide-scale lessons in philosophy from this history too. What we see in Locke, we see in all men. It is not possible to do epistemology apart from metaphysics. It's one of the things when you read Dr. Van Til's works in apologetics, he stresses over and over again. People fool themselves that they're just going to take an objective, neutral approach to how they know what they know. But they can't approach knowing without already having some idea of what they know and what the world is like in which they know it. So I like to use this illustration when I'm out lecturing. Let's imagine that I own an apple orchard, and I want to develop a machine for sorting apples, the good from the bad. I mean, that would be helpful, wouldn't it? Then I could just harvest my apples, toss them into this bin that goes into this machine, and then we wait for the machine to do its work, and at the end, the bad apples go over this way, the good out that way, so I know what I can take to market and sell. That'd be very valuable, wouldn't it? And so the machine is my method of analysis, if you will. The machine is the way in which I sort the good from the bad. Now, the analogy here is, imagine that the machine is sorting the true from the false. That's what epistemology does. Your theory of knowledge tells you what you know, how you know, and so forth. So I want to develop an epistemological method in my story. I want to develop an apple sorting machine. Okay? Can I develop my epistemology without knowing what apples are like and what are good apples and what are bad apples? Think about it. If I were doing this apple machine, before I could make the machine work properly, I'd have to know already what a good apple is and a bad apple is, so I could instruct the machine, quote unquote, devise the machine so that it picks out the bad ones as bad and the good ones as good. And so I can't start with a machine that knows nothing about apples, goodness and badness, develop my method, as it were, and then I wait at the end of the line, pardon me, for the apples to come out. Here's the good, here are the bad. In the same way, it is totally artificial to think you can develop a theory of knowledge without understanding what the world is like and what some basic truths and falsities are. If I don't already know what some things are as true, if I don't have some truth, if I don't already have some knowledge, then I can't develop a method for gaining knowledge and sorting it over against error. Y'all with me here? Which is to say, before I can develop my epistemology, I must already know something about apples. I must already know something about reality. So you cannot separate these two, but Locke thought that he was doing so. He thought he was developing his epistemology. But as a matter of fact, he assumed a number of metaphysical perspectives that were controversial. Not everyone would agree with them. And in particular, and you'll find this interesting since he didn't like the continental rationalist, Locke really did assume a Cartesian outlook on the world. He said the world is made up of minds and bodies. The world is made up of minds and bodies, and minds know only their own ideas. And these ideas somehow represent the external world of bodies. All right? The metaphysic of dualism, tied to the conviction that minds only know ideas, and thirdly, that ideas are representational of bodies. You may happen to agree with all three of those. I don't know. I would caution you about jumping in too quickly. But if you do, the fact of the matter is all three are controversial in philosophy. Does the mind only know bodies, or does the mind know things?
Does it know the objects, or does it only know something that stands between the object and the mind and idea? And what's the nature of idea? Is idea representational? And if so, how so? Anyway, Locke took these things for granted, but those are metaphysical assumptions. He just never seemed to realize, and it's those things that are going to get him into trouble eventually. If we want to know the extent of human understanding, it seemed very natural to Locke then that what we have to study is the origin of our ideas. Where do our ideas come from? Anybody like Leibniz, here we go, these guys are contemporary with each other, right? Anybody like Leibniz, who gives these vast metaphysical schemes, had better be able to trace his ideas for the nature of reality back to their origin. If you find out where those ideas come from, then you know something about their truth or their falsity. Okay, number two in my outline on Locke, his rejection of innate ideas. Most everybody in Locke's day, he thought, had the idea that there are native ideas that we have, all of us have native ideas that are antecedent to all of our experience and that have been implanted in us by God. There are ideas which we all come into the world with, if you will, natively, and they precede observation or experience. And because there's a religious sanction claimed for them, they come from God, then anybody who criticized them could be silenced by religious authority. And Locke didn't like that. Locke said, these innate ideas are utterly worthless. No one has ever advanced science or made a new practical discovery by resting upon what are called innate ideas. Moreover, he says, those who are dogmatic call all their pet ideas innate. That's clever, isn't it? Okay. As we were driving to class today, I said something that Jay challenged, and I told him that it was self-evident. It was an innate idea. See? And he knew better than to take me seriously. He chuckled at that. But you see, in that day and age, people were not chuckling because all these very self-important dogmatists would say it's an innate idea. Locke said, you just take your pet ideas and you protect them from analysis and cross-examination by calling them innate. And nothing's ever been helped by this. And so he was very critical of the dogmatism of innate ideas. But Locke had his own naive conception of the relationship of the mind to its experiences. He didn't like innate ideas, but what he proposed in its place is going to prove to be very problematic itself. Reminiscence of Francis Bacon, remember that name from last week? Reminiscent of Francis Bacon, Locke said that the mind at birth is a blank tablet on which experience subsequently writes. The Latin for blank tablet, tabula rasa. The mind is a tabula rasa. It's a blank tablet, or if you will, a blank board up here. And then experience is like this marking pen that comes and writes on the blank tablet of the mind. Okay, so this is a basic paradigm or picture for Locke of how we know. The tablet doesn't have any innate ideas. It doesn't. How would you like it if you bought, you know, a package of typing paper at the store and you open it up and it already has some things typed on it? He says, when we start out life, we don't begin with things already typed on the blank page. It's blank. And the only thing that types things on the page is experience. And what I'm saying is, that is an incredibly naive view of how we know what we know. Yes, it does get rid of the dogmatism of the rationalists with all of their pet theories and, you know, they're trying to shield themselves from criticism. But I don't think it really helped in the end in terms of developing an epistemology. So Locke argued, and I quote, "No proposition can be said to be in the mind which it never yet knew, which it was never yet conscious of." No proposition can be in the mind that you are not conscious of. So you didn't come into this world with innate ideas. Remember our timeline? Locke and Leibniz are contemporaries. And so Leibniz argues against Locke on this point, being a continental rationalist, and Leibniz has the better argument here, although you know that I'm critical of Leibniz too. Leibniz said, well, a person can know a proposition without being able to state it formally. See, Locke, you've made this mistake of thinking that you don't have innate knowledge because you're not aware of the knowledge. But you can know things without being able to state those things. So there's a criticism that you need to get down. And what Locke has done is confused or has been ambiguous about this idea of where ideas, quote, originate. Originate can mean what is the occasion of my coming to know something, or originate can mean what is the source of its truthfulness. Okay, what's the origin of that idea? That may be asking for what's the source of its truth. What's the basis, if you will, the foundation of its truth? But originate can also be a psychological question. What made you think of that? And Locke didn't seem to distinguish these as clearly as he should have. Locke thought that the rationalists were talking about the ideas that originate in perception, that they were talking about the source of our ideas, and then he criticized them because they took it to be the source of the truth of our ideas and then rejected it as a source of truth. According to Leibniz, the issue is not whether everybody recognizes the innate truths. The real question is, are there innate truths? And so Locke had himself confused the psychological question, do we recognize things, with the epistemological question, are there truths which are self-evident? And this is interesting. Leibniz was willing to go along with Locke in saying that all of our knowledge begins with particulars. And he was willing to say that there's nothing in our minds at the beginning of our experience other than our several experiences. Well, how can Leibniz and Locke be in different schools of thought then? Leibniz is willing to say we don't know until we have experience. And there's nothing in our mind, there are no experiences in our mind when we begin. Can any of you feel what's coming? Well, the difference is that Leibniz and Locke had different views of the mind. We could put it this way. For Leibniz, the mind has depth, not just surface. And so, yeah, there's nothing on the surface, if you will, at the beginning of your life. But it's only because the mind has these innate ideas, the potential for processing information, that you can ever have an experience. Okay? So Leibniz says, Locke, you haven't done anything against continental rationalism when you say, well, you couldn't know anything. It's senseless to claim that people know things that they haven't formulated and are aware of. He said, well, yeah, there are things that we know that we're not aware of. We come into this world, if you will, with a capacity or disposition to know things. That mind is not blank then. It's pre-programmed. In our day, we have analogies that would not have been available earlier to explain this, but I think you can all, I trust all of you know how computers work and use some kind of word processing program, right? But let me ask you this. When you bought, I happen to use WordStar, and I think it's superior to all the rest, and I'll be glad to debate that with you at lunch. No. When I bought WordStar, did WordStar have my essays written, or maybe the first line of my essays written? Did that program come already with essays in it? I mean, well, it may have in terms of the learning program, but that's a different issue here. WordStar, as a processing program, doesn't provide you with the actual output, does it? And yet, I couldn't sit there at the keyboard and write my essays if WordStar didn't have some programming. Y'all follow that? And so, to use a modern analogy, Leibniz says, I agree that WordStar arrives with no essays in it, but I disagree that it arrives blank. It's programmed. Granted, if no one ever pushes the keys, you're never going to get anything out of it. If you don't have experiences of particulars, you're not going to get anything out of it. But that doesn't prove your point that there are no innate ideas. And so Locke and Leibniz, you see, really differed at a very fundamental level as to what's the nature of the mind. Locke would have been very worried that the Leibnizian assumption of, if you will, unconscious depth of programming in the mind is really just a convenient way to get to your uncritical dream metaphysics. He would have said, see, let's go back to my WordStar analogy. What if I tell you, not only I agree WordStar arrives without essays in it, but there's programming, and then I go on to say, and by the way, this programming proves everything that I'll ever say. You say, hey, now, wait a minute. And Locke, I'm doing an anachronistic metaphor here, but Locke would have said, Leibniz, I don't like your programming idea because I'm afraid you're just going to use that to prove anything you want. Okay, so what was the method that Descartes, where did that word come from? What was the method that Locke wanted to use? And this brings me to number three on the outline, his psychology of knowing. Locke called his method the historical plane method. You always like that, don't you, when there's this false humility in a philosopher. I'm just doing the historical plane method of learning. Nothing fancy about me. No programming in this computer. I'm just being very plain about this. This is just the way things happen historically. The historical plane method. His psychology of knowing can be summarized. We're going to say more about it, but we can summarize it in this thesis that all ideas derive from experience. All ideas derive from experience. Remember, the mind is a blank tablet, tabula rasa. There are no innate ideas. Well, where do we get our ideas then? From experience. The historical plane method was to be a procedure for tracing ideas back to their origin. But now, and I'm adding this critically, note that Locke confused the psychological study of the origin of ideas with the epistemological theory that only experience can confirm or disconfirm our beliefs. That is, he thought he was pursuing the historical plane method, looking for the origin of ideas, but in so doing, he also thought he was giving an epistemology. And if you stop and think about that, those are different issues, aren't they? And you know why? Because psychology is descriptive. Epistemology is normative. And so you can tell me all you want about the origin of ideas, but it may be that the origin of ideas, the way that we think, is all messed up. In the end, you've got to have an epistemological theory that says this is the right way to think, the wrong way to think. This is what verifies or disconfirms your beliefs. That's a normative type issue. And already we see that Locke is off on a psychological jag, if you will. What's the origin of ideas? And he confused the origin of ideas with the normative question of what makes things acceptable or unacceptable epistemologically. According to Locke, all of our experiences are either inner or outer. That is, we have either the data of external sensation or we have the data of introspection. That is the way in which our mind operates and organizes the data. Okay? External experience, sensation, internal experience is the operation of my mind. All experience is like that. And then he went on to draw a distinction between simple and complex ideas. Is the idea of a golden mountain simple or complex? Well, it should be obvious to you that a golden mountain involves both the idea of a mountain